Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, May 14, 2014. South Sudan's army spokesman says the army won't tolerate attacks on government positions during the so-called tranquility period, but rebels denied carrying out attacks.
We'll continue to be strictly abided by the peace agreement, but will not allow this ceasefire to be used by rebels to continue moving, continue attacking our position.
And the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement admits it failed to fulfill the promises it made to the South Sudanese people.
We have managed our oil economy well, but we have not been able to diversify our economy so that agriculture plays a role, mining plays a role, services play a role.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Sudan People's Liberation Army officials accuse opposition of continuing attacks for the third straight day since the new cessation of hostility agreement went into effect, a charge the opposition staunchly denies. Both are blaming each other for fighting and are calling on the international monitors to arrive and report on the situation. Philip Aleu has the story for VOA from Juba.
SPLA spokesperson Colonel Philip Aguirre says today fighting took place in three places, including outside United States capital Bentiu. He says the other clashes occurred in remote parts of Jonglei and Upper Nile states. Aguirre says the government has launched a formal complaint with the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, OIGAD, which is mediating peace talks and is supposed to be imposing a ceasefire.
We'll continue to be strictly abided by the peace agreement, but will not allow this ceasefire to be used by rebels to continue moving, continue attacking our position.
Opposition military spokesperson Lul Rai Kwang dismissed the accusations.
I think they are just quick to accuse us whenever they launch an attack. They would be the first to run to South Sudan TV to accuse us because they have that propaganda machine at their disposal.
Kwang says he will welcome the deployment of the IGAD monitors. IGAD officials say they have not been able to deploy the monitors across war-torn areas of the country because they do not yet have troops in place to protect them. Foreign Affairs Minister Barnaba Marial Benjamin says the government will uphold the cessation of hostilities agreement, which President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar signed last week in Addis Ababa. He says he cannot guarantee fighting will stop.
If rebels attack a town which is not supposed to be under them, it is the right of the government to protect that town, protect its citizens, which is their constitutional authority.
Both Mariar and Kwang say the government is working to create humanitarian corridors so that aid groups can assist people who have been caught in combat zones, though they will not say when those corridors will be open. For BOA News, I'm Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
Lucy Pony contributed to this story from Nairobi. International humanitarian group Oxfam has released an emergency appeal today to try to prevent a possible famine in South Sudan. The United Nations is warning that 1.3 million people already face emergency-level food shortages in the country. Philip Aleu has that story for VOA from Juba.
Colin Bryan, Oxfam Advocacy Manager in South Sudan, says the situation will continue to deteriorate unless more money arrives soon. He says the number of people who go hungry in this country could skyrocket to 7 million before the end of the year unless Oxfam receives much-needed food aid within weeks.
So it's not just a question of access, it's a question of surge capacity and also a question of increased funding in order to enable us to do that. We're talking about providing immediate needs for that size of population, but also preventing others from slipping into those categories of being food insecure.
Oxfam is asking governments to make up the shortfall in the United Nations $1.27 billion appeal to provide relief to South Sudan. So far, only 40% of the money has been pledged. The UN is hosting a conference in Norway next week in a bid to drive up the total. UN officials have reported the bulk of the money will be used not to purchase food, but to transport it. The current rainy season makes much of the country impassable, which means food will have to be a drop. Brian says that while the international community effort will be critical to staving off a famine, it is also the responsibility of the government to do what it can to help.
Right now, what people need, firstly, they need to feel safe. They need to feel that, you know, even if fighting has ceased, that they feel safe, that they feel that they can go back home, that they have safe passage back home. And then on top of that, they need seeds and they need tools. So many of these things have been lost in the fighting itself. In many cases, people have been forced to eat the seed that they would have sown.
Brian says the key areas of need are in Jonglei, Unity and Upper Nile, the states that have seen the heaviest fighting. For BOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
The Geneva-based Internal Displacement Monitoring Center says South Sudan contributed to more than 33 million people who were internally displaced at the end of 2013 due to conflict and violence. From Geneva, Lisha Schlein reports that there is a staggering increase of 4.5 million from the previous year.
The report by the Norwegian Refugee Council notes about two-thirds of the 33.3 million internally displaced people are in just five countries: Syria, Colombia, Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sudan. This is the first time Nigeria is included in these global statistics, and the report documents 3.3 million Nigerians displaced within their own country. The Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland, says that number includes nearly 500,000 driven from their homes during 2013.
Of the 470,000 displaced in Nigeria last year, about 300,000 were displaced due to Boko Haram, the conflict between Boko Haram and counter-insurgency forces, and violence from Boko Haram. 170,000 displaced by intercommunal strife in Nigeria. 470,000 altogether.
The report says Syria has the highest total of IDPs, 6.5 million. Egeland calls Syria the epicenter of violent forced displacement. Every day, 9,500 people, about one family every 60 seconds, is being displaced in Syria. Egeland cites the Central African Republic as another exploding crisis, with nearly 1 million people newly displaced. He also points to South Sudan, where 380,000 people became displaced in 2013, and the total now has reached 1 million. Egeland says people who are displaced in their own countries are in a state of absolute crisis. Because they have not crossed the border, they are not entitled to the same international protections afforded refugees. He says they are unprotected, extremely vulnerable, and very often lack assistance. He says the figures in the report are the worst since the international community began recording internally displaced figures in 1989.
It is worse than the bleakest and blackest hours of the 1990s, with the genocides in Bosnia, elsewhere on the Balkans, and in Rwanda and in the Congo. At that time, it peaked around 28 million. Then we have had a decrease. We're now talking 1995-96. Since 2000, there has been a relentless increase in the number of internally displaced. But the last 2 years have been by far the worst.
Egeland says he fears the number of people fleeing their homes will continue to escalate. He says nations must work more closely together to end this misery for millions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A top South Sudan ruling party official says South Sudan has yet to achieve the dream for which the Sudan People's Liberation Movement was formed 31 years ago. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
As the country prepares to commemorate the 31st anniversary of the SPLM on Friday, the ruling party held a news conference to decry the violence that has left thousands dead and displaced more than a million South Sudanese from their homes in the last 5 months. Anne Ito is the SPLM's acting secretary general.
We still have security issues, and we are all aware of what is happening in Jonglei, Upper Nile, and unity. Even before that, the cattle rustling, the ethnic fights, yes, we have them.
Ito tried to outline her party's achievements since the signing of the CPA that led to South Sudan's independence, but admitted the government has done little to improve the economy.
We have managed our oil economy well, but we have not been able to diversify our economy so that agriculture plays a role, mining plays a role, services play a role. So we still have a lot more work to do in the area of the economy.
Asked why there are delays in payment of civil servants' salaries, Ito insisted that the government has had several financial obligations that did not leave enough money left over to pay government employees.
We have obligations to pay Khartoum what we agreed to pay as a financial settlement following the independence of South Sudan. We have obligations to pay loans that the government took from some companies who provided services. Now, when war comes, who does not know? Providing extra security means extra money.
She says due to the fighting, oil production was halted in some of the oil fields, leading to a reduction in oil production, and the revenues the government had been receiving were cut short. And Ito says, despite an end to the civil war that led to South Sudan's independence from Sudan, not much has been done to address the psychosocial effects of the conflict on South Sudanese. She says thousands of people traumatized by the last war have not received the necessary treatment. She called on citizens to work with the government to improve services.
The question now is, how do we address these challenges? Not through picking up guns, but through sitting down and examining where we have not done enough. Whether it is training, whether it is bringing new technology, be it the diversification of the economy, it is time, after 31 years of our liberation struggle, to sit down and ask, how can we do better? How can we take our people closer to our dream country, to the home we want to build?
Ito says another big challenge is the nation's high rate of illiteracy, which she says makes it harder for the government to help people find gainful employment. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
From South Sudan, we travel to neighboring Kenya, where a rights group says the ongoing security operation is riddled with abuses, resulting in arbitrary detention, harassment, and forced relocation. The government crackdown began in early April following attacks by unknown gunmen in Mombasa and Nairobi. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Operation Usalama Watch was launched after gunmen killed 12 people in two attacks in March. Much of the security crackdown is centered on Nairobi's Eastleigh and South Sea neighborhoods and the Likoni area of Mombasa. Human Rights Watch researcher Letitia Bader says that's where you'll find thousands of Somalis, ethnic Somali Kenyans, South Sudanese, and Kenyan Muslims.
We're concerned with how the operation is being carried out, both in terms of ongoing abusive, arbitrary arrests. So in terms of the security forces going to people's homes, raiding homes, houses, buildings.
The group is also critical of conditions at places where detainees are being held.
We've been visiting different police stations in Nairobi where detainees have been held in horrifying conditions, overcrowded, lack of sanitary facilities, lack of food and water, but also in terms of the legality of the detention. Individuals have been held for much longer than what is stipulated under Kenyan law, and it's very unclear why they are being held.
Bader says it's also not clear how many people are being detained.
Well, that's a very good question. The problem is, at the moment, no one and no protection actors actually have access to all the detention facilities where people are being held. So we've heard from the Kenyan authorities numbers up to thousands of people being detained, but key actors haven't been given access to the detention facilities to really clarify and corroborate this information.
She says journalists, Kenyan citizens, and international aid workers have also been harassed. Human Rights Watch also accuses security forces of taking cell phones, money, and other items, including documentation.
The authorities are claiming that what they are trying to do is identify undocumented individuals in this country. But the truth is that in the way the operation is being carried out, they are often overlooking valid documentation. They've been destroying refugee cards, identification cards.
Bader says Kenya has the right to carry out security operations in the wake of attacks. However, she says, authorities have not yet brought individuals to court for the attacks in Mombasa and Nairobi. Human Rights Watch makes a number of recommendations, including giving access to UN officials.
At a minimum, the UN Refugee Organization, UNHCR, is given access to all detention facilities where individuals are being held to make sure that refugees are identified, but also individuals who haven't had the option and the possibility to claim asylum in Kenya, given that registration of asylum seekers has stopped over the last few years. It's absolutely critical that UNHCR has access to all detainees.
The group also calls on Kenyan authorities to make sure its security operation meets human rights standards. Last month, authorities said Operation Usalama Watch had progressed well and was intensified, arresting criminals, suspected terrorists, and illegal aliens. More than 200 people have been scheduled to be deported or sent back to the Dadaab refugee camps in northeast Kenya. At the time, authorities said they were waiting to see official reports of police misconduct. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
In recent years, Africans have made progress in the fight against HIV/AIDS. Prevention programs, new medicines, and changes in behavior have brought infection rates down dramatically. But this success could be in danger if people are not careful about sexual activity. Those displaced from their homes by war and civil unrest are at a greater risk of sexual violence, which can spread the disease. Advice and information are available from health centers in many areas. So understand the risks, take precautions, and protect yourself from HIV/AIDS.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the latest on Nigeria's schoolgirl abductions. Stay tuned.
You don't want to miss VOA's South Sudan in Focus, and there are now a number of options for listening. You can hear us on one of our FM affiliate stations around the country. Check out our website, voanews.com/South Sudan, for the listings. In Juba, you can listen to South Sudan in Focus at 8 p.m. on 93.5, VOA's 24-hour station. You can also find us on the following shortwave frequencies, 11620, 13870, and 15180 kilohertz. Or you can listen on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan. You can also download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
should married couples share all financial assets and costs equally?
Initially, a man is supposed to take care of a woman. I mean, that's why you took me away from my family, so that you can take care of me, right? Obviously, I expect you to take care of me, but if circumstances don't allow you to take care of me, like if financially we're not okay, I can chip in.
Of course, since they decided to become couples, they are supposed to share the assets together. A couple should go other way, or should his or her partner as long as they decided to stay as couple, they should share their financial assets or whatever they have in the household.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. In Nigeria, lawmakers have passed a bill criminalizing the willful transmission of HIV/AIDS. Civil society groups say the move will aggravate stigma and hamper efforts to fight the disease. VOA's Hilary Hula has details from Kampala.
The bill, which the Ugandan parliament approved on Tuesday, imposes tough jail sentences of up to 10 years for those found guilty of willful and intentional transmission of HIV. It also requires that pregnant women and their partners get tested for the virus. Member of Parliament Peter Alepper told local television last week that people who knowingly transmit HIV to others are dangerous.
Every punishment should be given because this person is aware that he or she is infected and goes ahead intentionally to transmit to another person. And that's a very dangerous person that can easily confuse the whole community and finish people.
But health workers and civil society groups have spoken out against the bill, saying it will do nothing to curb Uganda's rising infection rate. Many argue the bill will further stigmatize people who are HIV positive. Margaret Happy, of the National Forum of People Living with HIV/AIDS Networks in Uganda, says that the risk of criminalization is also likely to keep people from getting tested.
It instills fear in both women and men, because many people will not go for HIV testing then. Because if one goes for HIV testing, then at one point he or she will be caught up by this bill. And yet HIV testing is an entry point to accessing other HIV prevention services.
This new law was passed months after Uganda enacted a tough law that imposes life sentences in prison for committing some homosexual acts. In recent years, a number of other African countries have passed laws against transmitting HIV, including Kenya, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe. Other countries also have such laws, and some American states have them. Other countries, including some European nations, have prosecuted people for transmitting HIV under other laws against harming others. The Ugandan bill needs President Yoweri Museveni's signature to become law. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. Rescuers in western Turkey are searching for survivors after an electrical explosion and fire at a coal mine killed at least 205 people in one of the country's worst mining accidents ever. Rescue workers today pumped fresh air into the mine into the Turkish town of Soma, south of Istanbul, as they struggled to get hundreds of trapped miners out. Officials say 787 people were inside the mine when an electrical unit exploded, causing a fire inside the mine in western Manisa province. Officials warn that the death toll could rise. Ukraine is hosting national unity talks today, a day after pro-Russian separatists killed seven government soldiers in the eastern part of the country and amid unconfirmed reports of fresh violence there. Ukraine's president, national lawmakers, and regional officials are attending the talks in Kiev, which are part of a so-called roadmap plan laid out by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And finally, a South African judge has ordered runner Oscar Pistorius to undergo psychiatric tests, bringing a stop to his trial on charges that he murdered his girlfriend at his home last year. The judge announced her ruling today, saying the move is not a punishment for Pistorius, but rather to make sure he gets a fair trial. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Activists in Nigeria say the kidnapping of more than 300 schoolgirls in the north a month ago was no isolated incident. The abduction of women and girls in Nigeria is a much larger problem, they say, and kidnappers are never or almost punished. Heather Maddock has more for VOA from Abuja.
Hey, you should come down. There's an order.
A protest of a couple of hundred people in the Nigerian capital on Tuesday got heated after Borno State Governor Kashim Shettima spoke. A month after the girls were kidnapped from Borno, Islamist militants known as Boko Haram are holding more than 250 in a forest hideout. Shettima explained part of the reason the girls are still missing.
In an insurgency operation like we are currently undergoing, it's the terrorists that are setting the pace of the war. There are people who know the terrain very well. They are the ones who are setting the agenda. So naturally, they tend to have the upper hand.
He says the abduction of the girls from Chibok town last month was not the first time Boko Haram has attempted to kidnap large groups of children from their schools. It was just the first time they were not stopped. Borno residents say Boko Haram has long been kidnapping women and girls and forcing them to be their so-called wives. The group says it wants to install its harsh version of Islamic law in Nigeria, but some analysts say its operations appear to be geared more towards wanton destruction than imposing an ideology. Outside the governor's office, some activists say the kidnapping is part of a larger problem in Nigeria, where the abduction of women and girls goes largely unpunished. Actress Dorothy Njamanzi narrowly escaped abduction in Abuja 2 years ago after she was beaten and molested.
Now we're here talking about another spate of abductions because other spates of abductions were not spoken against. They were encouraged by the government's silence, and now we have yet another dimension to abductions. Honestly, my heart is broken.
Kidnapping is also on the rise again in the Niger Delta, an oil-rich region in the south, where militants have risen up against oil companies and the government several times, says lawyer Phyllis Obasahang. In his office in Wari, a rundown oil city, Obasahan says kidnapped victims in the Niger Delta tend to be adults, taken for ransom. But he says the problem continues for much the same reason as in the north. Even when the kidnappers are caught and arrested, they are hardly ever convicted, he says.
There are a few ones on trial, but for conviction, there has not been really a strong one.
Other activists demanding the rescue of the girls agree, but they say at this point they're not concerned with what happens after the girls are freed. Media coordinator Rotimi Olaole is with the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, a loose coalition of activist groups organizing rallies online and on the streets, demanding the safe return of the girls.
What we want the most is that our girls come out alive, and after that we're ready to work and support government to ensure that this do not happen again, and that abductions are reduced to the barest minimum.
Boko Haram released a video this week that included more than 100 kidnapped girls wearing Muslim headscarves. The man who claims to lead Boko Haram, Abubakar Shakau, says in a separate scene in the video, he converted the girls to Islam and is willing to trade them for the return of some of his imprisoned members. On Wednesday, the government reiterated that it will explore all options for the release and safe return of the girls. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
That's all we have for you tonight. We now leave you with the music from a Kenyan musician, Musa Juma, and his song New Sudan.
Milambo Abana personalities Southern region
Karango tiyo matek sana Afrika Zimbe okedo malich sana Afrika Kelijo kedo matek sana Afrika Acholi koda sande kinupidi Shiluku koda madigiti kalu Nyalita Joseph Lakongo, General Joseph Lakongo,
Oscar. Joke de Pili Sudan Mamilango, Equatorial personalities, Southern region. Joke de Pili Sudan Mamilango,
have been listening to Musa Juma and the song New Sudan. I'm your host, John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow at the same time for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Albino, Olivia, Tio Matek, Sanae.